On this episode of Skeptico, guest host Dr. Rich Grego discusses cross-cultural parapsychology with Dr. Hoyt Edge.
I do remember a kind of epiphanal moment and hearing about the Aboriginal worldview, the dream time.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I began to say, here's a different vocabulary. Here's an entirely different way of looking at the world. And it's been around for 40 to 50,000 years. As a pragmatist, it's worked.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we have a guest host, Dr. Richard Grego, who's going to bring us a very interesting interview with parapsychologist Dr. Hoyt Edge. I did a little bit of an introductory interview with Rich that I think explains what's coming up, so let's get right to that. Today I want to introduce you to Dr. Richard Grego, a professor at Florida State College, and he's a professor in the area of philosophy, religion, and cultural history. Rich, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I wanted to introduce people to you because you've brought us today, and we're going to play it in a minute, a very fascinating interview with Dr. Hoyt Edge, who is quite a well-known parapsychologist with kind of a long history in the field and a lot of interesting experiences and anecdotes to share with us. But before I get into that, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and then why you decided to bring us this interview with Dr. Edge?
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, just really briefly, I guess. I'm a professional philosopher myself at Florida State College in Daytona Beach, and Hoyt Edge is a philosopher, of course, at Rollins College, which is about 30 or 40 miles adjacent to me in Orlando, Florida. And I followed his work for quite some time because initially in my prior career as a criminal investigator and a private investigator, actually, I became intrigued by the prospect of exploring mysteries in general and sort of the epistemic issues that are involved in that process. So when I became a professional philosopher, I was sort of drawn to the areas of philosophical inquiry that addressed sort of the radically mysterious dimensions, I guess you'd call them, of consciousness and existence, like consciousness studies and cosmology and metaphysics and philosophy of science and religion, a lot of the things that you talk about, of course, on Skeptico. And then that, in turn, led to an interest in parapsychology and the philosophical foundations of that. And then that sort of, in turn, led me to the work that Hoyt Edge was doing, among other people, many of whom, again, you've spoken with in your broadcast, and it led me to an interest in Skeptico and the what I think is the really important work that you're doing. That's kind of what led me to Hoyt Edge. And just briefly about Hoyt, of course, he's a philosopher, and he's a pretty preeminent figure in the field of parapsychology as well. And he's been the past president of the Parapsychological Association. He's currently serving on their board of directors, and his areas of research include, things like consciousness studies, mind-body problem, and the philosophical foundations of parapsychology. And I think, not only that, but being a person who I think, a thinker who is a skeptic in the authentic sense of that term, as opposed to the sort of pseudo-skepticism that I think some people in the field of parapsychology are currently engaged in, I thought that he would be a perfect fit for the spirit of Skeptico.
Great. And one aspect that he's explored that I didn't know about, and I really didn't know much about him at all, but was this cross-cultural look at consciousness. And I thought that was really fascinating, and I enjoyed in this interview when you guys got into that. Do you have any thoughts or any interest in that yourself?
Very much so, yeah. And as a matter of fact, I think, there are several, as you know, and because you've talked to several of them, philosophical figures that are working in that, you know, along those lines in parapsychology. But I think that's something really an area of research that Hoyt brings to bear on the field that's unique. And I think, especially in terms of this conversation, one of my two big takeaways from this encounter was that for me anyway, I feel that he's pointed out sort of two big impediments to progress in the field of parapsychology and maybe in the field of consciousness studies in general. One of them, I think, being these Cartesian sort of assumptions he talks about that continue to sort of configure the paradigm and conceptual framework of contemporary parapsychology and science, really. And then the other, I think, is the sort of failure on our part to recognize some of the epistemic limitations of the scientific purview, mm-hmm. and to the exclusion of other maybe traditions that could shed some important from other cultures that could shed some important light on parapsychological research.
Great. Well said. And that's a great tee up for this interview that we're about to hear. I do have to say, with all that, you know, the interview was both enlightening and frustrating at the same time, because I felt like in a way it mirrors the field of parapsychology, at least as the way that I see it, where it almost gets to the point of saying something and then retreats back and really doesn't wind up saying anything. And I really like in the end how you pushed him on some of the just glaring holes in the field. I mean, you pushed my near-death experience because it's a hole. You got to kind of resolve what that means. And he kind of climbs that mountain, but then just kind of falls back down. He also pushed him on skeptics and whether he's skeptical enough about people like Richard Wiseman and Susan Blackmore. And I had to wonder that even if those folks might make good house guests, if they're really trustworthy, reliable researchers in a way that we could really accept their view of things. So those are just some of the thoughts that I had, but I don't want to tip my hand too much. I mainly just want to thank you for bringing this. And now let's get on to your interview with Dr. Hoyt Edge.
Thanks. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome and hello, and I'm privileged to be here today with Dr. Hoyt Edge. He is the Hugh and Jeanette McKean Chair and Professor of Philosophy at Rollins College, and was past president and is currently serving on the board of directors of the Parapsychological Association. And his areas of research include philosophical anthropology and cross-cultural concepts of consciousness, personhood, the mind-body problem, experimental philosophy, and the philosophical foundations of parapsychology. He's authored numerous articles and conference papers on these topics, as well as the book A Constructive Postmodern Perspective on Self and Community, From Atomism to Holism. And today he's going to be sharing his insights and reflections on the field of parapsychology in general, with hopefully particular attention to its theoretical foundations and its philosophical implications, which are very interesting. And actually, just to dispel any confusion on the part of skeptical listeners that may be hearing a strange voice conducting this interview, my name is Rich Grego, and I'm a philosopher at Florida State College. So again, welcome, Hoyt. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks. Happy to do it.
Great. I guess a good place to start maybe would be for you to perhaps share some sort of biographical reflections of professionally and personally on what it was that led your sort of scholarly and research interests in the direction sort of consciousness generally, and I guess, or the person generally, and parapsychology in particular. Because I know it sounds as though you've had a long journey. If you began as sort of, I read as you told me, an epiphenomenalist, and which I mean, even more than maybe straightforward materialism, is what you'd think is antithetical to the paradigm that parapsychology seems to be sort of working within that you can think of. But what got you here?
Yeah, well, I suppose if we want to go back even further than the epiphenomenalism, I had in high school the sort of traditional religion versus science dilemma. Having grown up as a fairly traditionally religious person, and this was the 50s and 60s, and where science was king, and so I began searching, and I was in particular interested in just what does it mean to be a person, that the kind of materialistic, reductionistic approach to the person did not seem adequate to me. And yet, on the other hand, what was important to me was a scientific approach. Mm-hmm. That is, I was impressed enough with science that I wanted to pursue that. I went into philosophy. Why epiphenomenalism? Well, I focused on the mind-body problem, and if I took my dissertation was essentially rejecting a materialist view of Richard Rorty, who was popular at the time. He came out with his fundamental article on illimitivism in 65. And then another article in 68, and then supporting epiphenomenalism. Why epiphenomenalism? Well, I guess two reasons. One, my dissertation advisor was an epiphenomenalist, and it's, politically, it's always helpful to have that sort of connection. On the other hand, it made sense. That is, if you make certain assumptions, epiphenomenalism makes a lot of sense.
And actually, not to interrupt, just skeptical listeners are very sophisticated, but they might not be familiar with the jargon that we throw around in our profession.
Epiphenomenalism, by the way, I tried to make that as the first word I taught my daughter when she was born. Needless to say, it did not work. But epiphenomenalism is a view that the mind is an impotent byproduct of physical processes. That is, it is a kind of dualism in that it asserts both mind and body. It asserts consciousness and body, but it says that the mind doesn't do anything. It's like the smoke coming out of a smokestack, where all of the work goes on within the factory. Sort of all of the work goes on within the brain.
So consciousness exists, but it's just a byproduct and an impotent one of physical processes in the brain.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And so so I argued for it, and I actually had a section on parapsychology in it, in which I took the traditional kind of skeptical view and said, well, it's not possible, as I'd been proven. And I knew that my philosophers would not disagree with this. Indeed, it never was brought up. But there was enough of a question in that. And then the other thing, and one of the sort of few parapsychologically related events that have happened to me is I went to school near Casadega, which is the winter home of the Spiritualist Association.
Yeah, it's a society in Central Florida.
That's right. And so I went over there as a student, took a date over, and was not very impressed, but went back a couple of years later and had an interview with a psychic who was who said some pretty impressive things, among which, by the way, I was essentially going there to see if I could find some topic for my dissertation. And she said, "Oh, I see you doing experiments."
Yeah, interesting.
And I remember laughing at her and saying, "I'm a philosopher. We don't do experiments." Well, she's laughing at me now. But I sort of got interested in this. And then when I came to Rollins in 1970, she was over here in a spiritualist church. Mm. And I made contact with her again. And sort of my interest there, plus my interest in William James.
Yeah.
Who also was a philosophical interest in William James, but he was interested in
Absolutely.
Psychical research, as you know. And so I, and maybe I should say sort of a third thing that got me interested in parapsychology, and that was after graduate school, I was a little, how shall I say, tired of philosophy. It was done so professionally. And what I found was that through parapsychology, you could ask all of the traditional philosophical questions. What is knowledge? What is causation? And in particular, what is the person? And that's what I was interested in. What does it mean to be a person? And through that interest, I actually became involved in a lot of different things. In the human potentials movement, I was interested in mystical experiences. I was influenced by Gene Houston and built a device called the Altered States of Consciousness Induction Device that she and her husband, Bob Masters, had created. And actually sought to produce mystical experiences, and I was able to do that in some students, and so I was just interested, and I was very interested in meditation. How is it that we can understand the person in a non-reductionist way, and yet look at this in a systematic way that is scientific? Is it uses the methodology of science.
Were you still, when you were doing these, working with these mystical experience-inducing apparatuses and stuff, were you still under the influence of the sort of epiphenomenalist framework at that time, and were you still looking for mechanistic sort of material explanations?
Yes and no. I mean, as a matter of fact, I did argue for epiphenomenalism, but in my junior year of college, I studied at the University of Freiburg in Germany, and I had a course where we read Carl Jaspers, the existentialist, the Christian existentialist. And what he did was he gave me a kind of entree of being able to talk about the person in an ethical way without the metaphysical trappings of that I had come to question. And so I also was sort of interested in existentialism, and because of William James, I was also interested in pragmatism. And so here were alternative ways I was just seeking and not seeing how they were fitting together and so forth. So at that time, I was pretty well convinced that epiphenomenalism was not right, but I wasn't sure what was there.
Interesting.
And so, I mean, in one sense, what you could say is the rest of my life has been on the same journey. And I have, expanded it to the cross-cultural, but it's really asking the same thing.
And I guess before we leave your autobiography, was there any sort of epiphanies you had along the way, or really milestone experiences or personalities or influences that you had that really made you evolve substantially in a short period of time, or was this evolution really just been gradual?
I think it's probably been gradual. I think early on it was the influence of Jean Houston and her work, and also I went up and took a 3-week workshop with her, and the kinds of states of consciousness that I was able to achieve at that time sort of led me in the direction of saying something really profound is here. And she talked about what she called the integral experience, what might be the mystical experience. And I began to get kind of glimpses of that also. So if there was anyone, I suppose it was she.
Oh, okay. All right, and that's interesting, because reading sort of the corpus of your work, I get the one of the really big themes, and again, if I'm not doing justice to it, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the really pervasive themes I sense in the many essays I've read and presentations of yours is that one of the sort of attitudes toward consciousness, or the sort of a paradigm that's kind of impeding the progress of parapsychology, are these holdovers, these legacies of Cartesian dualism that see the mind and body, first of all, as sort of radically different. Mind-body dualism, I guess, as you'd call it in classical terms. And then the sense of the individual or the person or the individual consciousness being a very highly individuated, separate, disengaged entity from the rest of the universe or the environment. Is that correct? And why is that a problem? I mean, I know I also recognize that you acknowledge its, in a sense, contribution to the history of parapsychology, but you seem to think that maybe we've outgrown it now?
Yes. I tell my students that I do not believe in the virgin birth of ideas. That is, ideas have a history, and they come from someplace, and we don't usually think of them that way.
Yeah.
It was Einstein who said, common sense is the prejudice that we develop by the age of 17. Okay?
Yeah.
Our first years, the purpose of those is to inculcate our culture as if it is true and nothing else is true, and there's no other way of looking at the world.
Right.
And in a sense, I was a kind of product of that also.
Mm.
So this kind of individualist view of the self and so forth came very natural to me too.
Sure.
I mean, my first years in parapsychology, I really tried to defend dualism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I spent a lot of time trying to defend dualism and the potential for survival, not that I really believed in it, but at least as a theoretical possibility, as a concept of the person that we could have.
Yeah.
And so it was really only later that I began to see... I actually began running up to a roadblock that I didn't read a whole lot of mysticism, but I sort of recognized there was, or Eastern thought, that there was a different language there.
Yeah.
And I was using this sort of Eastern traditional philosophical language.
Yeah.
And I say something's wrong with it, but I'm not sure what it is. Yeah. And I don't have any alternatives.
Mm.
You know, I'm not a good enough thinker, as it were, to figure out how else to talk about the person.
Sure.
And I do remember a kind of epiphanal moment in Sydney, Australia, sitting in on a course that it was a Rollins course offered by us. We have a program in Sydney, and it was offered by an anthropologist on Australian Aborigines.
Wow.
And reading this article and listening and hearing about the Aboriginal worldview, the dream time.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I began to say, here's a different vocabulary. Here's an entirely different way of looking at the world. And it's been around for 40 to 50,000 years. As a pragmatist, it's worked.
Yeah.
Okay? And so, and then that same trip, I spent a week up in Bali. Almost, and talk about a synchronicity. I didn't plan it. Last minute, sort of, well, why not? Got connected to a guy that I worked with for years over there. And I experienced the Balinese worldview and trance over there. And the person I was with was very interested in trance. And so it was that experience in 82 or 83 that said, okay, there are really different ways of thinking about the person, and they are legitimate, and they are long-term, and they are deep, and they are profound.
Right.
What I need to do is to begin understanding what those are. And so my research then began then first among the Australian Aborigines, and then a little later more focused on the Balinese.
Right. And I guess that kind of segues into the next, I think, really important aspect of your, one of the important, what I see is one of the really important themes of your work in general. But I mean, before we move to you know, comparative sort of cultural constructs of the self and what we would call normal or paranormal or parapsychological, what is it specifically, though, about Cartesian dualism and individualism or individuation, if you want to call it that? What is it about that that you think is a constraint on parapsychological research sort of in particular?
Right. It is. It has had a profound effect, not only on me, but I've argued that J.B. Rhine, who really set the stage for experimental parapsychology, was a thoroughgoing a dualist.
Yeah.
And I have argued and argued this, that Cartesian dualism argues that mind and body are just two radically different sorts of things with different kinds of characteristics. That when you talk about matter or the body, you talk about sort of inert, unthinking, spatial, mechanical, determined, public objects.
Sure.
Which Descartes was not the thoroughgoing atomist, but science then was atomistic. So you add the science onto that, and you get this view that there is what these are basically are atoms.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, it's just the opposite of mind. Minds are thinking, non-spatial, meaning-producing, purposeful agents, and they are subjective and they are private.
Right.
Now, in a sense, this yields the problem of parapsychology.
Yeah.
Because parapsychology traditionally has thought about telepathy as how is it that two minds interact?
Right.
Well, why is this a problem? Well, minds are not material things. We can understand how material things can interact,
right,
but these are mental things. How is it that they interact, especially if you don't, if there is a barrier that cuts off any kind of physical interaction? And so parapsychology is itself this idea that says somehow there are relationships that we don't understand. Now you can go to sort of a cosmic consciousness, or some parapsychologists have gone in the direction of basic of a kind of pure consciousness where we go down and that's where sort of the interaction works in this kind of cosmic consciousness, but outside of that, it is this notion of there is a relationship that is going on here, and atomism, on the other hand, is a view that says the only way there can be a relationship is, I mean, it's a billiard ball kind of view. The only way there can be a connection is that if sort of one bumps up against another one, that there is contact, that there has to be that contiguity. So there is a tension here. And so while Rhine was a dualist, and one understands why he's a dualist, I mean, traditionally one understands about survival. Well, how can, we know that matter disintegrates. Well, so there has to be something radically different. And so dualism is something that speaks to that possibility.
Yeah.
Plus, if science is defined in terms of this reductive materialism, then we can't go to a traditional science, and so we've got to have something else. So you can understand why, if the only options are dualism and materialism, you can understand why parapsychologists would go toward dualism.
And you think that that's unnecessarily restrictive, those
indeed.
Two choices, right? It's false dichotomy.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But it was the kind of dichotomy that I worked with at first. Because with that prejudice I learned at 17, you know, and really perpetuated by Western Cartesian thought.
Yeah.
I mean, there are
sure.
glimpses in Western thought,
right.
the white heads, the phenomenology,
yeah.
and so forth. But the bedrock Western philosophers are in this tradition.
Sure.
And so, yeah, so there is that yeah. inherent tradition. And so what these other worldviews, these non-Western worldviews did for me, mm-hmm. it opened up the possibility of saying there's something else besides those two options.
Yeah. And therefore, and I guess that gets us into the next, I think, big sort of theme that I see emerging from your work and what for me has been a really constructive contribution you've made to this line of thought, and that's that perhaps then, well, not perhaps, I guess you kind of assert that this concept of mind and body, all these sort of Cartesian dualisms and atomism and individuation are really just sort of biased cultural constructs of ours, and that if you go to other cultures, the things that we assume about consciousness just don't even apply. They don't even think within those frameworks. So that I guess that would mean then that what in philosophy and I guess consciousness studies in general we call the hard problem is only a problem then by virtue of our cultural bias, correct? Because
yeah.
Other cultures don't really, obviously, right, have, rather than a dualistic, they have, or an atomistic, they have a relational view of the self and its environment and the
yeah.
world.
Yeah.
So I guess then, what does that say about what parapsychology is doing? I mean, it says maybe potentially a lot of really radical things about the nature of parapsychology. For one thing, I guess that would mean that the hard problem, as we say in consciousness studies and philosophy, is maybe only a problem because of our inability to expand our paradigm. Is that correct?
Yeah.
About the self?
Well, yeah.
And maybe we should explain
the hard
problem.
At least we have made it harder. And the
yeah.
hard problem in Western philosophy is that if you have this dualism, if you have this notion of consciousness that is so radically different from physical matter, how is it that they interact? We understand how billiard balls can interact.
Right.
That is, there is that yeah. knocking together. But one, we don't understand, we don't see a contact in the billiard ball paradigm kind of thing. And
yeah.
secondly, given the notion that laws of nature are sort of universal and they're deterministic,
yeah.
there's no room for anything outside of nature to affect nature.
Yeah.
Whether or not it is finite consciousness or individual consciousness.
Yeah.
I mean, a finite consciousness or infinite consciousness. So when we talk about infinite consciousness, that is, God parting the Red Sea,
right.
we call it a miracle.
Right.
The same sort of problem exists for individual consciousness.
Hmm.
Every act of mind on the body would be a miracle.
Yeah.
Okay? And
right.
so something
yeah.
doesn't work there.
Yeah.
Okay? There's just no room
yeah.
for it to happen. And so it's the hard problem. So what do we do? Yeah, is this a construction? Well, I love Richard Rorty. In spite of the fact I argued against Rorty in my dissertation, I've always thought he's just really, really wonderful. And he says the mind was invented in the 17th century. And that is this particular notion of the Cartesian mind was
right.
an invention. And what it seems to me we've got to understand is that matter, our body, was also invented in the 17th century. Not as if, it's not like, Democritus existed and he talked
yeah.
about atoms and so forth. But what happened in the 17th century was we developed science with this notion of matter. Science was invented in the 17th century, okay? And we sort of
right.
accept that, 16th, 17th century, sort of accept that. But what we've got to understand is these notions were accepted in relationship to each other. So matter was the opposite of mind. Mind, that there is a kind of conceptual cluster that goes on here. What I'm talking about is that there are other conceptual clusters that exist that I have experienced in among the Aborigines, among the Balinese, and in some other cultures. And of course, there are out there, and they work and they make sense. I mean, you can argue all of these are social constructs in a sense. This is where my pragmatism come in. So what we've got to do is to say what works and what works the best. And some of them may work really well in some situations and not work so well in other situations.
Right.
I'm very, very impressed with contemporary science and what it does.
Yeah.
It works. Okay, as a pragmatist, I've got to say it works and is true and so far forth. And yet, along with William James, I am someone who wants to say if there are other concepts that work, then those are true also.
Also, yeah.
Right. And so, whereas you will want to talk about agency, that is, people do things.
Yeah.
And in almost all cultures, they want to talk about people doing things.
Right.
When you have this hard problem, what you want to say, the doing is a mental mind affecting a physical body.
Right.
And that's how you explain the doing or the agency.
Yeah.
That's what I question as opposed to other ways of talking about agency.
What I guess then, and you've sort of suggested in your writing again a few ways in which, and certainly you've studied extensively, you know, other cultures, particularly Bali. I know you've done a lot of research and cross-cultural studies of how, say, the Balinese construct their notion of reality and the person and the environment and the relationship between those, as opposed to the way we do in the West. What do you think that, as a model or a framework from which to work, that parapsychology can learn from, say, the Balinese or any of these what we would call traditional or primal cultures and their more relational, say, attitude toward the relationship between humanity, you know, the person or the consciousness in the world. It does seem, I guess, right, as though the notion of a radically relational, again, say, this coextensive, that we're really integral, a part and parcel of the environment that we're around instead of a separate entities, certainly maps better onto the notion of psychokinesis and, all these kinds of things, survival and things like that, than the Cartesian paradigm, right?
Yes.
Is that sort of what you're saying? That maybe we can use those concepts in parapsychology?
Yes. What I have been most interested in is focusing on this notion of the self or the person, because I think it is so central.
Yeah.
Now, I did do Bob Morris, who was a giant in parapsychology, started a project where he was wanting to understand the notion of volition.
Yeah.
Did work in Edinburgh, did work in Freiburg, because when we sit down and say, okay, let's just take a simple card guessing sort of thing, we say, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to make a choice and say which is the card going to come up, star or cross or circle or whatever it is, or if it's a PK experiment. Okay, what I want you to do is I want you to try to affect this random event generator in a certain way so that a light stays on or something like this. In both those cases, what we're asking to do, the participant, the subject to do, is to assert volition.
Right.
It's to try something.
Yeah.
And so what Bob said was, gee, if we could understand this notion of volition better, then on the one hand, we might contribute to normal psychology because this is something they're interested in, and therefore they may be open to parapsychology. And secondly, we might have some insight into volition in terms of how we work with our subjects. And so one of the things I did was I did a volition, working with Balinese, with Professor Soriani in particular. I carried out a survey in Bali, trying to understand this notion of volition. And what we found out was that there are four factors that were similar to the factors we found, or that he found in Edinburgh. And so in some senses, this notion of volition might be a kind of universal notion.
Yeah.
And yet there were other aspects of volition in Bali that seemed to be much more culturally oriented. And they began to undercut my notion of collectivism.
Yeah.
Because my notion of collectivism was that, you take the 20th century notions of collectivism in the West, fascism or communism or something.
Right.
It's a kind of top-down, heavy-handed. You've got to do this, and the end, and the individual is just sort of saluting the flag. Right.
Yeah.
So what I found out was the Balinese didn't look at it that way. They, in fact, reported that they were as free, and in some cases, more free than Americans.
Yeah.
And so I began to get at this construct of agency that was a different kind of agency that takes place in collectivism. And it is an agency that is far more concerned about not asserting one's individual agency, but as connecting to the environment, to others, to the community, and so forth. So again, it showed me that there were different kinds of cultural constructs. So I do think that parapsychology and the cross-cultural work is an important aspect for parapsychology. I also think, and others are better at talking about this, that quantum mechanics is offering parapsychology a lot of insight as to how we can think about parapsychological phenomena too.
And I was going to ask you, what you think about a little bit about those things. Well, I know you're not a physicist, but I'm sure you've had
far from a physicist. Yes,
I'm sure you've had ample opportunity to reflect in your position, but. There are a couple of other things I wanted to address about that, some of the things you just said, because I suppose, again, one is this notion, I guess, this is something of a digression. I don't want to dwell too much on it, I suppose, but there is this notion that, you sort of see it in the West, and you see it in parapsychology, that in order for the norms and the beliefs of traditional peoples, for instance, the Balinese, to sort of pass muster with us, for us to accept them, because what they engage regularly, I suppose, in their culture in what we would call paranormal experiences and parapsychological experiences, and they think nothing of them. They speak to the dead. They hear other people's thoughts. That kind of thing, and yet. It seems as though we're not willing to accept that unless their standard of truth passes muster somehow with our great, institution science. And it just seems as though perhaps there's a certain degree of cultural, depending, I suppose, on the spirit in which you do it, but there's a certain degree of cultural arrogance in that, cultural imperialism, I guess, as constructivists would say. Because, these things are all paranormal to us only because of our hang-ups, our cultural biases. So do you find that that's the case? Do you think that there's a certain degree of that in parapsychology, particularly because it seems to be a field that is bending over backwards to prove its scientific credentials, to be as tough-minded and as to get the approval of the scientific community as possible. Do you find that that's the case, or have you found that that's the case in parapsychology?
Yes, and perhaps I just need to confess to the fact is from the very beginning, when I had this sort of science religion issue, I have always kind of said, okay, there is something to science here that is really, really important.
Yeah.
And parapsychology I have looked more closely at those aspects of parapsychology that have been engaged in the scientific enterprise.
And in
my own work, my work in Bali, Bali in particular,
right.
I have sort of taken a Western paradigm of experimentation over there.
Yes, yeah.
Now, why is this? Part of this is to say, well, I know that it probably wouldn't be accepted unless I do this. Something else is I want to try to begin to discern for myself what's going on. There are some wonderful, wonderful articles. There's a book, it's called something about Clever Men, about Australian Aborigines.
Hmm.
And it talks about all these events and so forth. And it talks about healing. And this has been pointed out. When indeed there is healing, we sometimes catch healers in what would be sleight of hand.
Yeah.
Okay?
Sure.
And what are we to say to that? Well, when we ask them, it turns out to be far more complicated. From our point of view, if something is sort of sleight of hand, we just say, uh-oh, we're getting a red eye, there's nothing in there. But I think they recognize sort of the mental aspect of health.
Yeah.
And so part of it is this notion of belief, and working on that belief. And so the kind of dichotomy that we have in the West between truth and not truth doesn't work in these other cultures.
Okay.
An example would be in logic, in Western logic, we want something to be, and in science, we want something to be absolutely clear. Sure. Define your terms with absolute clarity. And that's what's sought. When you look at poetry, what is sought is an image that is rife with meaning.
Yeah.
And the Balinese, that's their approach to the world.
Right.
That is, things are more important if there's polysemy, if there are many meanings that are there,
right.
Okay? And so, in many aspects that are there. So our commitment in the West to this one absolute truth may very well be this commitment, a philosophical commitment, or it could be a kind of religious commitment of this one God sort of thing and one truth and so forth.
Sure.
And when you get to cultures that don't have that tradition, understanding how they think, I think, is very, very important.
I guess then, it's a very practical question, asked from the Western paradigm of either or, have you come away with the impression that when the Balinese, for instance, or anybody, or the people that you've looked at, are speaking to spirits, that they're really speaking to spirits?
Yeah.
Or do you think that it's metaphor in some sense? I mean, I guess that's the issue. Yeah, that would be certainly, that's the issue for parapsychologists. Are they really doing this?
Right.
And we just don't see it because they have means that we don't have, or what do you think?
Right, right. Coming up from it from a Western perspective, I have often thought that the approach of poltergeists and so forth, sort of the Bill Roll perspective, that it's recurrent spontaneous PK, that I have tended toward that view.
Mm.
Now I did do a study of mediumship in Bali.
Yeah.
And it is just far more complicated. Mm. Their understanding of mediumship is far more complicated.
Right.
That they view themselves as not simply kind of bringing information from a spiritual world, but also as mediating that world. And in some way, I mean, they have what the anthropologists would call a sort of a magical worldview, and sort of what is true on the inside is true on the outside, and all of these worlds, the spiritual world and the common world, the secular world, are not split in that same way.
Right.
And so the categories don't work. So I have no doubt that they are engaged in spiritual activities. Given that they are not Cartesian, they think that there is this entity that is there? I'm not so sure about that.
That's interesting.
There are forces, there are powers. These are absolutely real to them.
Yeah.
And they're quite willing to talk in very human terms. I mean, after all, you can talk about the world in very abstract terms or very human terms and talk about the processes of the world in very human terms. That's how they want to talk about it.
Sure.
And so they talk about it in very human terms, but it's not clear to me that they want to assert a Cartesian mind. Yeah.
And along those lines, I guess this was another issue that I kind of wanted to address, because getting back to this whole theme of Cartesian dualism and individualism, atomism, individuation, it does seem as though reports of, and this is a this subject is of particular concern, I know, to the producer, so he might even want to address this, although I don't know if he would address it along these lines. It seems as though survival experiences entail those characteristics in a way that the Cartesian paradigm prescribes, right? That in other words, when people survive bodily death or have out-of-body experiences, one of the whatever they call them, those out-of-body OBEs, I guess, right?
Yeah.
They experience a sort of first-person subjective kind of a consciousness, which suggests, I guess, a kind of atomism. And there is this evidence that even though brain activity has ceased, this conscious experience is continuing, which would also suggest a mind-body dualism, no? That there is some kind of a consciousness separate from our physical being. Wouldn't that then support, at least on some level, more of a support Cartesian, the classic sort of Cartesian dualism that parapsychology has been laboring with?
Yeah, except that you can have these sorts of experiences and talk about them in other ways in other cultures too. Mm-hmm. Now, first let me say, yes, you're right. I think there is this absolute tension. And looking at it from our tradition, that is true. And I was brought up a Protestant, and it is in Protestantism that this notion of a Cartesian self was far stronger than in Catholicism.
Right.
So in some sense, it's not even Western. It is even a narrow version of the West.
Yeah.
Given that we have worked things out philosophically and scientifically in those terms, it's natural to ask this kind of question.
Yeah.
And yes, I think the near-death experiences in particular are ones that where we want to say something is there that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Out-of-the-body experiences, to me, somewhat less, because we've not had the kind of evidence in those, I think, that are as strong and that are as controlled as we have had in near-death experiences.
Right, right. So I guess, again, because you have some expertise in this area, do the kind of near-death experiences with at least those characteristics, a subjective first-person consciousness surviving bodily death, are those cross-culturally valid as well? Do Balinese, for instance, experience that? Have there been the same kind of reports there? Or do they have a different experience?
Yes.
Do they experience a more relational kind of dissolution of the self or something? I don't know.
Right. That's right. I don't know about the Balinese. I do remember I talked to a sociologist in Australia who was very interested in this, and this was worked 15 or 20 years ago, actually. Mm. He was collecting some near-death experiences among Aborigines. And I think what you would find in other cultures is that there are some great similarities. and some of the near-death experiences that you would find, the tunnel or the white noise, the white light, and those sorts of things. Not necessarily this benevolent voice or something like this that you get. But I think you get some of those experiences, but you do get elements that are culturally related. Mm. And I have not done enough research to be able to say these are the sorts of things.
Okay. Yeah, I just wondered what your reflection on that was, since we've been talking so much about the limitations of the Cartesian sort of view in that respect. And again, I know I'm jumping around a lot. I wanted to get since we've been talking so much about science, are there particular trends now that you can see in the sciences? I know quantum entanglement is a great place to start, that you think are promising for, to support parapsychological research and psi phenomenon and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, as I am far from a physicist, and maybe that's why I'm so impressed with science, is that I don't know enough about it. I think quantum entanglement, from what I have read from other people, it is something that is just absolutely fundamental. I think it seems to me what's happening is that we sort of came up with this notion of matter and what science does, coming out of the 17th century, and we have these definitions, and we're still continuing to think in those terms, use that sort of language. Yeah. But as a matter of fact, when you look at the evidence, the meaning of those terms really have become different.
Yeah.
And we have not yet, and that's sort of inevitable, I think, okay? And this is why I'm saying, well, maybe we need to come up with new terms. Maybe that's why Whitehead came up with such radically different terms, because it's just so natural to, when we use those old terms, even if on one level of consciousness we say, well, they don't mean the same thing, we naturally fall into talking about them as if they are those old definitions.
Sure.
So, yes, I mean, when you look at contemporary, at subatomic physics, quantum mechanics, and so forth, what I think we see clearly is a complication. Mm. I mean, obviously, this traditional notion of atomism doesn't work.
Yeah.
And even the notion in some sense of is a particle an atom in the old sense?
Right.
Well, not really.
It's okay? Not really a thing, right? A subatomic particle.
Yeah. And so it's more complicated, but it's hard for us to, once we still continue to use that traditional language.
Right.
And it's hard for us to see the real implications of what science is talking about now.
Sure. And I guess, because I know it's still controversial. There's a number of physicists, I guess, working in parapsychology very productively who disclaim the quantum applications, even though they're physicists. Mm-hmm. But then there are others. I think maybe Dean Radin is an example.
He talked a lot about this. Yes.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
That
work.
See a lot of productive capacities in the field of quantum physics for parapsychology. I don't know where I want to go from here. I guess there's so many places you can. Is there anybody right now doing anything in particular in that regard that you can think of off the top of your head?
I don't know. I mean, I have read a lot. I read a lot of Radin. I think there's still work in Germany, actually, doing work with information systems that is interesting. I hope to learn more about it. I'm heading over to Germany this next month and hope to be finding out a lot more about that.
Yeah, I think that I was just listening to an interview with a guy, Wallach, at Northampton,
who
is applying what they call, I guess, generalized quantum theory.
Right.
Too, but again, the technicalities of it, I am not familiar with.
I can't
myself.
Either. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll leave it to the okay. physicists.
Along those lines, I guess, again, within the field in general, and this is getting back, I guess, to some of the limitations, I think, of our current sort of scientific paradigm. And actually, I guess, as many people, Stephen Browdy, for instance, yourself, a lot of people, of philosophers of science, sort of have pointed out that this thoroughgoing materialistic view and the reductionist kind of view of everything to materialism is more of a philosophical assumption than a scientific empirically valid proven assertion, I guess, either. But we do have, and I guess we always have, but it seems as though, and this is something that you're probably way more attuned to than I would be, in the parapsychological field now. You've got a group of people who are thoroughgoing, obvious materialists who seem to want to deny not only consciousness itself in a way, and that's a big debate right now in the philosophical community, but in the parapsychological community as well. They seem to want to just reduce everything, whether it's the Balinese, thousand-year-old Australian Aboriginal traditions, to reports that people in the West make. They seem to want to reduce all these parapsychological phenomenon, psi phenomenon, to just trivial sort of physical explanations. They're hoaxes, or they're neural malfunctioning in the brain, or they're hallucinations or mass hallucinations. Parapsychology has always faced that, but it appears, and this is what I want to ask you about, as though it's kind of unique in a sense, because of late there are a lot of people from within the field. I'm thinking of, and again, people like Wiseman and Alcock, yeah. I guess, who've gone so far as to say maybe we need closure.
Right.
In the field of parapsychology, maybe it should go the way of phrenology and eugenics, and all these dead ends. What do you? Is that a recent phenomenon? Is that something new? Or
well, first, I'm not sure. I would call, and I'm not sure they would want to call themselves parapsychologists.
Okay.
And so, but it is certainly the case that there are people who know about parapsychology, who sometimes are engaged in parapsychological research, that take the position that you do. Let me step back and say, it seems to me that it is absolutely clear one thing has happened, and that is when I got into parapsychology, I would say that almost all of the parapsychologists were dualists in one form or another. Even the physicists were dualists. I think now that the sort of the weight of the view is towards something else. Now, I would name that as a naturalism.
Okay.
And that's my own change over the last 35 to 40 years. And that is that it seems to me that now we're talking about the natural world.
Right.
Okay? If we no longer talk about matter the way that Descartes talked about matter and are careful about that, okay, then what we can say is that we're dealing with a natural world.
Okay.
If we're dealing with a natural world, this is sort of the epiphenomenalist part of me, because epiphenomenalism was a dualism, but it was a naturalism.
Yeah.
Okay, now I have eased off the dualism part, and I accept the naturalism part, except epiphenomenalism traditionally was far more materialistic than I am willing to accept. So that I still want to argue that we're dealing with natural phenomena here, and that we will be able to explain those, and with an expanded enough understanding of science, we will be able to do that. So that a lot of these people that you were talking about are in anomalistic psychology. What you will find is a number of parapsychologists, a lot of them perhaps, want to call the field a part of anomalistic psychology, or want to say at least that they're dealing with anomalies. and back off this notion that they are paranormal.
Right. Okay? Okay.
Now, is this a good thing? Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
It is for two reasons. One, it is just as Bob Morris said, what we ought to do if we want to have parapsychology mean something and parapsychology be paid attention to, if we can contribute something to normal psychology, then they're much more likely to say, oh, these are good people.
Yeah.
So that when they come up with other research, Daryl Beam, for instance, if he does something,
right.
Then psychologists have got to step back and say, oh, well, maybe I really need to take this seriously. I can't a priori say it's foolish.
Sure.
Okay. So in that sense, if we engage in this careful sort of work and be willing to say, you know, at times, this just doesn't look to be paranormal, anomalistic. I can't explain it away.
Right.
Okay. We don't have to say that that is in any way paranormal. Then they will say, okay, this is an objective person. We should look at this other person's work also. And then secondly, if you are a naturalist, so long as you're well aware that you should not slide into a reductionism.
Yeah.
It seems to me that this is really the direction that the field is going.
Yeah.
If, after all, we can bring in entanglement, quantum entanglement, as a way to start talking about these things, that's a naturalism.
Sure.
But it does say is that traditional parapsychology and traditional science sort of meets in the middle. And what we ought to do is, and everybody ought to do, and I fear that traditional scientists aren't, is ought to understand that now we're talking about an interestingly different world.
Yeah. Yeah. So instead of sort of, when you say naturalism, because very often that's sort of a catchword for the very reductive kind of scientism that I think some of the hard-nosed skeptics sort of are leveling at parapsychology now. Instead of that, you're proposing a natural kind of naturalism that is a more open-minded and expanded a kind of science.
Okay,
that what you're sort of saying?
Yeah, let me say, what I take naturalism to be is a denial that there is a two-tiered universe.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, that the phenomena can be understood, that there is an interrelationship, an interaction. There's not going to be a hard problem.
Yeah.
And there's not going to be a hard problem because there's no such thing as mind.
Yeah.
It's because those traditional notions of mind and body that are so radically different no longer hold. We talk about a natural world.
Right. Okay. And then as far as the sort of the specific, I get the sense that there are two main prongs of the sort of materialist attack from within, by people who've done some research, and again, maybe Wiseman would not be from within, but he's certainly, you know, he's certainly familiar with parapsychological research, and he's just a name that keeps coming to mind. There, as you know, you know better than me, there are a number, but one is that, first of all, maybe you could address them in turn, one of them is, first of all, parapsychology hasn't produced any really well-defined enough theory of psi or definition of psi that you can have a comprehensible, testable hypothesis even to begin to do responsible scientific research so that you can have things like falsifiability and predictability and things like that. And then the next sort of prong is that parapsychology hasn't produced, and this is, I think, it seems to me, the most contentious, and the next thing is that parapsychology hasn't produced legitimate empirical data to support a conclusion that psi phenomenon exists, or that there is anything, that there are anomalies even worth investigating. And that, obviously, I mean, because you go to one end of the spectrum and you'll have Richard Wiseman say that nothing of any, or French or Alcock, there are a bunch of names like that I think of right off the bat that'll say, well, there just hasn't been any good evidence that there's anything going on here that's worth investigating. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you'd have like a Dean Radin, and I think there's a Garrett Modell at the University of Colorado who's doing a lot of research, who say, yeah, sure there is. We're doing it all the time in our labs. Look at our data. And then they both seem to be looking at the same data, right, and coming to these radically different conclusions. But anyway, so those are the two. What do you think about that?
Well, perhaps I can deal with the second first.
Okay.
And let me say, I think Chris French is probably a little more open than some of the others.
Yeah.
I think he understands what really is anomalistic psychology and is not dedicated to necessarily giving it a materialist interpretation, a reductionistic interpretation. The second one is legitimate empirical data. Well, I just think there is. And I'm not surprised. There's very few things in the world where different people can look at and not come up with different interpretations.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that over the years we have presented good scientific data.
Yeah.
Now, am I disappointed at the pace of progress? Yes. Mm. When I was a young parapsychologist, boy, I thought parapsychology would now be counted as one of the major areas of psychology or science or something like this. And yet, on the other hand, and I don't think this is just an excuse, there are more chemists in Orlando than there are parapsychologists in the world.
Yeah.
And the chemists in Orlando probably have 100 times more money than parapsychology has in the rest of the world.
Right.
If chemistry depended upon Orlando chemists to produce results that bring it forward, it would be in pretty bad shape. And this doesn't say anything about the quality of Orlando chemists. It just is a reality.
Yeah.
So I think this is a legitimate. This is a legitimate concern. I'm sort of disappointed. I thought we would have come farther, but I think there are some reasons. And it also relates to the first thing you ask about, and that is, perhaps this is just too simplistic to say, is parapsychology a science? And I have to admit, I'm not a skeptic on this, but a little conservative on this. And what I want to say is, I think parapsychology is a kind of pre-science, but it is scientific. That is, if we take a robust notion of science, which is paradigm-based science, I think, in fact, the criticisms of parapsychology of not having a kind of accepted paradigm is legitimate.
Mm.
We have, in a sense, a lot of paradigms for individual research programs, but not a kind of coherent paradigm.
Right.
But having said that, I am absolutely convinced that this is a scientific enterprise, and the results of this enterprise should be accepted as scientific.
Mm. What do you think? To what do you attribute the resistance to accepting the data, the empirical data, on the part of the people that? There seem to be a group.
Okay, you're right. Those people. Well, one that I will say the legitimate part of it is, well, gee, if there's no paradigm to kind of bring this together and explain it, okay. And I think that's legitimate. And secondly, I've already said, it is possible for good people to look at data and come to different conclusions. Mm. Having said that, I will also have to say that that knowledge is constructed, and it's constructed out of a lot of different for a lot of different reasons, a lot of different personal reasons. And let me say, this applies as much to parapsychologists as to anyone else, so that this criticism is not solely aimed at these skeptics, But it is clear to me that just as it may be the case that someone stays in parapsychology because it's a good gig for one reason or another, because it goes to nice places where you can do research or where there are conferences or you can make a name for yourself, I think this also applies to some of those critics.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, okay. In other words, they've made a name by debunking.
To put
it simplistically, I guess.
Right. And it's not as if there's absolutely nothing to some of their criticisms and the debunking. I mean, I'm not saying that at all.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that, boy, if you've got a good gig going, gee, it's just human to kind of continue that good gig.
And your response to them, I'm trying to picture their... You know, their response to this, and to the, they would no doubt say, "Well, we can play that same game and say, you know, you guys who you know are pushing parapsychology are doing the same thing."
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, ultimately, in the end, I think it's got to boil down to sort of people getting together and openly and as openly as and honestly. Really trying to investigate.
Yeah.
There have been times where I think Richard Wiseman has tried to do that, doing an experiment with Marilyn Slitz.
Slitz, right. Yeah.
But then when that evidence turns out to be one that he didn't like, I think he's also perhaps been a little unfair also.
To explain it away or...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So, I don't know what... I like Richard. You know, I know Richard. I like him. Susan Blackmore is the same way.
Yes.
Susan has stayed in my home and so forth. I love Susan. And she's sort of gone out of parapsychology and do other sorts of things now.
Right.
You know, these are good people.
Yeah. I guess I always, again, not being a scientist, always, you know, had the view that, wow, those guys over at that side of the campus at least are coming up with objective results that, you know, once it's there on paper and in the form of measurable data, there's one answer and that's it, you know, and you can't miss, you know, there's no two ways about interpreting a objective scientific result, but...
Yeah.
Apparently that's the case.
Well, yeah. I mean, all you have to do is to sort of look at what's happening in the subatomic physics. Whether or not there is a particle faster than the speed of light. And we have the data and here it is. Yeah. And then the skeptic saying, no, you don't. And, you know, continuing with that. I mean, this is what is so interesting to me. And this is sort of getting into parapsychology. I learned... how prejudicial people were in the scientific community.
Yeah.
So I became far more skeptical of science in this process.
Yeah.
And yet, on the other hand, I found out how far more exciting science is than I ever thought it was.
Guess so.
It is a game, and it is an exciting game.
Yeah.
And it takes all of our wits to do good science.
Yeah.
And so so I think I have a much healthier view of science, both a little more positive and a little more skeptical than I had when I started out.
That makes sense. And again, before moving on, I mean, just sort of in closing on that part of the, on that topic, do you sense sort of maybe what's going on in parapsychology in terms of this debate reflects a larger cultural trend in which you between the sort of this polarized sort of radical sort of materialistic atheists camp and with the Daniel Dennett's to the Dawkins and the Hitchens crowd they hate this appellation, but they're sort of materialist fundamentalists versus the religious fundamentalists on the other side, and a lot of debate going on in between, and then you have in parapsychology, seems like a sort of a mirror image of that larger cultural debate going on. Do you think that that might be part of the problem as well, that you have sort of people that have
Oh, I
sort of a scientific fundamentalism, or
that's interesting. Yes, I mean that sort of connection you just made with parapsychology and the wider world is an interesting one. I hadn't thought about it. What I can do is though is answer the question most directly, and that is by saying, anthropologically speaking, humanism has been called one of the world's great religions, and there are times when people can take a stance, a kind of humanistic stance, that turns out to be as much religious as scientific.
Yeah.
And of course, in science, we talk about scientism.
Sure.
And this is a part of it. So yes, I do think, in fact, that there are some people who are almost religiously committed to that position, just as there are religious people religiously committed to other kinds of religion.
Yeah. Seems more paradoxical among scientists, but
yeah.
That's interesting. Well, I guess what I also wanted to talk about before I ask about maybe what you're going to be up to in the near future, or what you're working on now, is are there any developments in particular in the area, in any of the areas of big ones in parapsychology, whether it's survival or telekinesis or psychokinesis or any of these things, or any upcoming events in the parapsychological community or that you know of that would be good to share?
Well, there's always the annual Parapsychological Association conference. It's going to take place right around the middle of August, and I should know those dates, in Durham. North Carolina.
Okay.
And if they get on the website for the Parapsychological Association, they can get the information about that.
Great. Any particular presentations or anything you're aware of that you sound interesting?
No, we don't know yet. I'm on the program committee, but I haven't been sent any papers to look at, so we don't know. We don't yet know what's going to be done.
And is there anything in particular? I know this is right. They have to be off the top of your head. Has it been any interesting thing, any interesting work recently that has particularly, you know, interested you or blown you away? Or
well, yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I go to the PA conferences, and what I'm really interested in hearing is sort of different points of view. The last conference was in Brazil, and was sort of backed up to a Spiritist conference. And so we had opportunity to hear more sort of anthropological experiences, and of course, given my own interest, this was really really interesting. There were some awfully good papers. The invited paper, I think especially, was really good, and other ones. I think work going on, some of the work in Freiburg or in Germany is really interesting, and of course the work in Northampton and some other places.
What kind of stuff are they doing?
Part of it is far more psychological oriented there, and some of it is I guess what traditionally we would call sort of process oriented, but it is also in this area of how is it that you can understand, sort of views this as anomalistic psychology. As a matter of fact, I just got a book that has just been published last week, edited by Nicola Holt and Christine Simmons Moore and David Luke Christopher French, called Anomalistic Psychology.
Okay.
And it talks about sort of parapsychology, and it is for people in the school or the university doing work in anomalistic psychology. Okay. And a lot of this does talk about sort of psychological processes and who are the people who are having
experiences.
And what can we understand about those people.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting dynamic in understanding what you would say normal psychology and understanding psychological processes, and yet on the other hand, it is sort of introducing that there are these experiences that are very important to people,
And we need to understand them better.
Very interesting. And how about yourself? You, I know you work. I'm familiar with the article on the one journal article you're working on right now, cross culturally. But you doing any? Yeah. What are you, you're going to Germany? I understand.
Yeah, and I'm going to Germany, and we'll be talking to the parapsychologist there. We'll be giving a talk at the IGPP. And at the institute there in Freiburg,
on
talk about my Balinese research.
Oh, okay.
And talk about sort of the results. And I'm trying to finish a paper about that research. We did 6 years of DMILs work there, and we've only published the 2 years. And so I'm putting together a paper, trying to summarize that work and get them off. And as you well know, I'm still continuing work in what's called experimental parapsychology, experimental philosophy, trying to, again, work on this notion of how is it that we understand the person.
Right, yeah. And is there any, did you come to any, up with any radical earth-shaking conclusions in, for, that you're going to share with the parapsychology people in that study?
Yeah. It turns out Stefan Schmidt has an article that has been accepted by a journal who is there, and I'm going to be meeting with Stefan and working with him a little bit, finding out what he's doing a little more and his research there. But he's published an article looking at all of this, what I call cognitive DMIL research that was done in the U.S., done in Edinburgh, and then I did. And comes the conclusion in a meta-analysis that it is statistically significant.
Wow.
And
what experiences in particular?
It is the paradigm is that you have actually two people who are focusing on a lit candle. You have the participant who is asked over a period of 16 minutes to focus on a lit candle, and whenever they notice their mind is wandering from that focus, to press a button. That is connected to a computer, and so computer automatically notes the time. The computer is also connected to another computer in the sender or the helper's room who is focusing on this candle.
Very interesting.
And in periods of, in epochs of 1 minute, the computer randomly chooses, is this a help period or a control period? And during the help period, a person, that person is asked to meditate and focus on the candle with the intention of helping the person in the other room meditate and focus. During the control period, they're asked to think of something else, not to do that. And so the computer essentially counts up the number of button presses in the control period and in the help period. And if there are statistically more button presses in the control as in the help, that implies that the helper was able to help the person in the other room focus, and you and the focus meditation.
Very interesting. And he found that the results there were statistically significant.
Yes. Yes. Okay. What I found, well, I don't know if I should say this or not. I should, I should hold it off for to have in my paper to let you know what the results are. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. But that's fascinating. So that's what's coming up for you soon, and then the parapsychological conference, of course, and this summer.
Yes.
All right. Fantastic. I think I've exhausted. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
No, I think you've handled the subject very well.
I appreciate your time very much. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Hoyt Edge for joining us today on Skeptico. And thanks also to Dr. Richard Grego for bringing us this interview. You know, I really welcome the opportunity to collaborate with intelligent, interesting people like Dr. Rich Grego, who have a different perspective, different interest, and can bring that to the show. So I want to thank him for doing that. And I also want to encourage any of you out there who have an interview in you, an interview that you want to do, somebody who you really think needs to be brought to our Skeptico audience, please reach out, contact me. Let's see if we can collaborate together and get that done. Now, if you're new to Skeptico, or even if you're not new to Skeptico, be sure to check out the Skeptico website at SKEPTIKO. Don't forget the K. And there you'll find links to all our previous shows, an email, Facebook link to me, and a link to our forum where you can join in discussion with other folks who are interested in these topics. I have a couple of interesting shows coming up. Be sure to stay with me for that. In the meantime, take care. Bye for now.